BTO Beyond the Obvious, der Ökonomie-Podcast mit Dr. Daniel Stelter. Featured bei Handelsblatt.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zur neuesten Ausgabe meines Podcasts. Am heutigen Sonntag blicken wir auf den US-Dollar. Und wir gehen der Frage nach, ob der US-Dollar seine global dominierende Rolle behalten wird oder ob die Auguren recht haben, die sagen, Schluss ist mit Weltwährungsstatus. Und es gibt Konkurrenz. China arbeitet seit Jahren systematisch daran, die Dollardominanz zu brechen. Ein immer größerer Anteil des Handels wird nicht per Dollar abgewickelt, sondern in Renminbi. Schon jetzt liegt der Anteil bei rund 30%, nachdem auch Saudi-Arabien begonnen hat, die chinesische Währung zu akzeptieren. Viel spannender und vermutlich auch relevanter sind die Bemühungen Chinas, mittels Gold die eigene Währung attraktiver zu machen. Das Ganze ist, wie ich finde, hochspannend und hochrelevant. Ich hoffe, Sie finden das auch. Fangen wir also an.
BTO Beyond the Obvious, featured bei Handelsblatt.
Haben Sie schon mal direkt gehandelt, also so richtig direkt, so dass es gar nicht mehr direkter geht? Nein, dann sollten Sie es direkt mal mit der neuen App von Europas direktestem Direktbroker Tradegate Direct ausprobieren. Tradegate Direct wurde von Profis für Profis entwickelt und ist speziell für erfahrene Trader mit hoher Handelsfrequenz gemacht, die Wert auf Kontrolle, Effizienz und Unabhängigkeit legen. Die App ermöglicht Privatanlegern den unmittelbaren Direktzugang zur Tradegate Exchange, Europas liquidester Retailbörse. Zu den App-Features zählen Realtime-Watchlists mit bis zu 150 Titeln, intelligente Ordertypen und Performance-Analysen auf institutionellem Niveau. Mehr als 7000 Aktien, 3000 ETFs und tausende Mini-Futures sind über die App handelbar. Außerdem bleibt der gesamte Handel dauerhaft kostenfrei und das auch bei neuen regulatorischen Vorgaben. Die marktüblichen Spreads allerdings können wie bei anderen auch anfallen. Erleben Sie, wie direkter Börsenhandel im Hier und Jetzt funktioniert mit Tradegate Direct. Mehr Informationen in den Shownotes oder unter tradegate.direct.
Im Oktober berichtete der Internationale Währungsfonds über die Veränderungen der globalen Währungsreserven. Und das war durchaus interessant. So ist der Anteil des US-Dollars an den globalen Währungsreserven auf 56,3% gefallen, den niedrigsten Stand seit 30 Jahren. Profitiert davon hat übrigens nicht der Euro. Dessen Anteil liegt seit Jahren relativ konstant bei ungefähr 20%. Profitiert hat hingegen Gold. Der Anteil des Edelmetalls an den Zentralbankreserven der Welt ist auf 27% gestiegen und hat damit erstmals seit 1996 den Anteil von US-Staatsanleihen übertroffen. Damit setzt sich ein Trend fort, der bereits seit einigen Jahren andauert. Zentralbanken haben in den letzten 3 Jahren jeweils über 1000 Tonnen Gold pro Jahr gekauft. Doppelt so viel wie im Jahrzehnt zuvor. Und ein Land sticht davor. China. China verwendet Gold nicht nur, um die eigenen Reserven zu diversifizieren, sondern arbeitet auch daran, die Dollardominanz zu brechen. Die Neue Zürcher Zeitung berichtete kürzlich so darüber.
Schon vor einigen Jahren hat China begonnen, in großem Umfang Goldreserven aufzubauen. Charles-Henri Mouchot, der Chief Investment Officer der Bank SIZ, bezeichnet dies als kluge Strategie. In Zeiten des endlosen Gelddruckens verlieren Fiat-Währungen, welche nicht durch physische Güter wie Gold gedeckt sind, an Vertrauen. Die Goldreserven böten Schutz gegen das Abwertungsrisiko beim Dollar, so Mouchot. Zudem seien sie ein Symbol für die eigene Währungssouveränität. Der chinesische Yuan gewinnt an Legitimität sowie an Einfluss auf den globalen Finanzmärkten. Als Wake-up-Call bezeichnet Mouchot den Angriff Russlands auf die Ukraine, als die westlichen Länder die russischen Währungsreserven beschlagnahmten. Daraufhin intensivierte die chinesische Führung den Import von Gold mit dem Ziel, die Verletzlichkeit bei Sanktionen zu vermindern. Die Devisen aus dem Handelsüberschuss sollten nicht mehr in Dollar angelegt werden. Die Höhe dieser Einfuhren bleibt allerdings im Dunkeln. Laut den spärlichen offiziellen Daten erreichten die Käufe im Jahr 2023 nur 225 Tonnen. Zurzeit werden die Goldreserven der chinesischen Zentralbank mit 2300 Tonnen ausgewiesen. Viele Experten gehen allerdings davon aus, dass die effektiven Reserven bereits bei über 5000 Tonnen liegen.
Angesichts des Handelskonflikts mit den USA und der Beschlagnahme russischer Vermögen nach Beginn des Ukraine-Krieges ist es aus Sicht von China, aber auch natürlich anderen Staaten, sehr vernünftig, auf Gold als Alternative zu setzen. Wer wird denn schon gerne enteignet?
Gleichwohl erachten es Fachleute als unrealistisch, dass China beim Yuan zu einem Goldstandard zurückkehren könnte, wie dies beim Dollar nach dem Zweiten Weltkrieg bis in die 1970er Jahre der Fall war. Stattdessen verfolge das Land ein hybrides Modell mit einer teilweise goldgedeckten Währung, erklärt Charles-Henri Mouchon. Somit dienten die Reserven als Rückhalt, um das Vertrauen in den Yuan zu stärken.
Gut, also keine Rückkehr zu einem Goldstandard. Aber mit der Shanghai Gold Exchange, der weltweit führenden Börse für physisches Gold, bietet China anderen Ländern nun einen alternativen Ort an, um Gold zu handeln, aber auch, um es zu verwahren. Nach dem Motto, bei uns bist du sicher vor dem Zugriff der Amerikaner oder generell des Westens.
Den Fokus Chinas auf den physischen Goldhandel bezeichnen Fachleute als cleveren Schachzug. Das Land dominiere dieses Segment bereits mit einem weltweiten Marktanteil von 75% und wachse aggressiv weiter, sagt Alicia Garcia Herrero, Chefökonomin für Asien beim Vermögensverwalter Natixis. Peking lockt die Zentralbanken des globalen Südens dazu, Gold in den Tresoren der Shanghai Gold Exchange zu lagern, als aktionssichere Alternative zu London. Das Ziel sei die Errichtung eines goldenen Korridors, der von Südostasien über Saudi-Arabien bis nach Afrika reiche.
Parallel arbeitet China schon seit Jahren daran, einen immer größeren Anteil des eigenen Handels nicht mehr in Dollar, sondern in Renminbi abzuwickeln. Man muss es so sehen. Früher musste China sich Dollar besorgen, um beispielsweise Rohstoffe zu kaufen. Die Strategie ist also, vor allem den Einkauf von Rohstoffen zukünftig in eigener Währung bezahlen zu können. Ein unglaublicher Vorteil. Von den USA wissen wir, sie können quasi einfach grüne Zettel drucken und damit weltweit einkaufen. Und die Chinesen möchten das sehr gerne auch. Wir Europäer übrigens bezahlen unsere Ölrechnung nach wie vor in Dollar. Die Chinesen immer weniger. Schon jetzt liegt der Anteil des Handels in eigener Währung bei rund 30%. Und vor allem war es ein großer Erfolg, dass nun auch Saudi-Arabien begonnen hat, die chinesische Währung zu akzeptieren. Wir erinnern uns, die Zusage Saudi-Arabiens, Öl nur gegen Dollar zu verkaufen, war nach dem Zerfall des Bretton Woods-Systems die wesentliche Stützung für den US-Dollar und hat damit dem US-Dollar damals die dominante Rolle gesichert. Doch nicht nur akzeptiert jetzt Saudi-Arabien auch Renminbi als Währung, die Chinesen sind auch in anderer Hinsicht sehr aktiv. So haben sie bilaterale Währungsswap-Linien mit über 40 Zentralbanken abgeschlossen, von Argentinien über die Türkei bis Saudi-Arabien. Und dies mit einem Gesamtvolumen von fast 600 Milliarden Dollar Gegenwert. Das heißt, China agiert faktisch als Kreditgeber der letzten Instanz für viele Schwellenländer. Wenn die also Probleme haben, können sie sich quasi bei China immer Geld besorgen. Das ist zum einen eine Aufwertung der chinesischen Währung, zum anderen natürlich eine Ausweitung des chinesischen Einflusses in der gesamten Welt und vor allem bei den Schwellenländern. Es gibt noch eine weitere wichtige Säule beim chinesischen Angriff auf die derzeitige Weltwährungsordnung, nämlich der Versuch, mit dem Cross-Border Interbank Payment System, CIPS, eine Alternative zum US-Dollar-basierten SWIFT-System für den internationalen Zahlungsverkehr zu etablieren. Heute ist es so, dass Zahlungen beispielsweise aus Deutschland nach Brasilien über SWIFT so funktionieren, dass zunächst Euro in Dollar gewechselt werden, dann diese Dollar transferiert werden, um dann vor Ort wieder in brasilianische Real getauscht zu werden. Das ist natürlich sehr umständlich und vor allem ist es auch sehr sanktionsanfällig. Denn wir wissen, das SWIFT-System ist zwar in Belgien domiziliert, steht aber unter sehr starkem Einfluss der US-Regierung. So kann die US-Regierung beispielsweise Sanktionen durchsetzen und damit Zahlungsverkehr für Länder einschränken. Diese Sanktionsanfälligkeit zu umgehen ist eine Motivation. Die andere Motivation ist, dass das chinesische Modell deutlich schneller funktioniert und einfacher zu handeln ist als das SWIFT-System. Schon jetzt sind die Transaktionen über das chinesische System stark gestiegen und ich glaube, es ist realistisch davon auszugehen, dass dieses System weiterhin große Wachstumsraten erzielen wird und sich damit über Zeit zu einer echten Alternative zum SWIFT-System entwickelt. Wir sehen also, China ist mit seinen Verbündeten aktiv dabei, die Dominanz des US-Dollars zu brechen. Die Motivlage ist klar, hat doch die dominierende Weltwährung erhebliche Vorteile für das Land, welches über diese Weltwährung verfügt. Man kann im Prinzip überall auf der Welt Schulden machen, auf Kredit Dinge einkaufen und letztlich über seine Verhältnisse leben. Die Amerikaner haben es seit Jahrzehnten getan und haben davon, im Unterschied zu dem, was Donald Trump immer wieder behauptet, deutlich profitiert. Dies ist nicht nur den Chinesen ein Dorn im Auge, sondern auch den Russen, den Indern, den Brasilianern etc. Deshalb ist dieser Druck sehr stark zu sagen, wir wollen uns unabhängig machen, um eben nicht nur Sanktionen zu umgehen, sondern um eben auch die Möglichkeit zu haben, in eigener Währung global einzukaufen. Vermutlich können die Chinesen und ihre Mitstreiter es gar nicht fassen, wie großzügig die USA sie bei dem Projekt Stürzung der Dominanz des US-Dollars unterstützen. Ja, die USA helfen aktiv mit. Das ist nicht nur meine These, sondern es ist auch die These von Professor Kenneth Rogoff, dem ehemaligen Chefökonom des Internationalen Währungsfonds und Harvard-Professor, die er in seinem neuen Buch Our Dollar, Your Problem darlegt. Rogoff ist recht nüchtern. Er sagt, dominierende Währungen halten meistens nur so 100 bis 200 Jahre ihren Status und dann werden sich eine andere Währung einer aufstrebenden Nation abgelöst. So wie der US-Dollar das Pfund abgelöst hat und zuvor das Pfund den Gulden. Der Dollar, so Rogoff, befindet sich am Ende seines Lebenszyklus. Er spricht von einem späten Mittelalter. Zum Vergleich. Vorherige Leitwährungen wie der spanische Peso, der holländische Gulden oder das britische Pfund wurden ebenfalls irgendwann von neuen Herausforderern abgelöst, meist durch Konflikte oder aber auch durch wirtschaftliche Fortschritte. In seinem Buch analysiert Rogoff, warum die bisherigen Herausforderer des Dollars gescheitert sind. Der sowjetische Rubel, der japanische Yen und der europäische Euro. Aber auch der chinesische Renminbi. Bis jetzt zumindest. Die Gründe sind für ihn klar. Zum einen fehlende wirtschaftliche Stärke, aber auch politische und fiskalische Uneinigkeit oder strikte Kapitalverkehrskontrollen. Kapitalverkehrskontrollen sind aus Sicht von Rogoff der Grund dafür, warum der Renminbi bis heute noch nicht den Dollar gechallenged hat. Ich persönlich glaube, dass die Politik der Chinesen sehr klug ist, vor allem in der Verbindung mit dem Gold, auf das kommen wir gleich noch, was dazu führt, dass unter Umständen eben der Renminbi trotz Kapitalverkehrskontrollen in eine führende Rolle kommen kann. Führend heißt hier nicht, den US-Dollar ersetzen, aber eine gleichberechtigte Rolle im Weltfinanzsystem zu spielen. Die Gefahren für die Dominanz des US-Dollars sieht Rogoff denn auch im Inneren. Vor allem die steigende Verschuldung des US-Staates macht ihm Sorgen. Rogoff verweist darauf, dass die Schuldenquote 1979 noch bei 30% lag und heute bei über 120% des Bruttoinlandsproduktes und weiter stark wachsend ist. Sorgen machen ihm auch die zunehmenden Versuche, die Unabhängigkeit der US-Notenbank einzuschränken. Wir hatten das bereits auch am letzten Mittwoch im BTO Refresh andiskutiert. Deshalb sieht Rogoff auch das Risiko neuer Inflationswellen. Und diese würden den US-Dollar natürlich unattraktiver machen. Denn wer möchte schon eine Währung halten, die noch schneller als normal an Wert verliert? Hogoff beschreibt zudem eine, wie er sagt, Superzyklustheorie der Schulden. Er sieht quasi Finanzkrisen, die quasi um die Welt herum wandern. In den 90er Jahren war Asien betroffen. Wir hatten die Asienkrise und wir hatten das Platzen der Blase am Immobilienmarkt in Japan. In den 2000er Jahren kam es dann zur Finanzkrise in den USA und zur Eurokrise in Europa. Und für Rogoff ist China der Krisenherd der 2020er Jahre. Einfach deshalb, weil China hochverschuldet ist und wir wissen, dass es erhebliche Überkapazitäten im Immobilienmarkt, aber auch in einigen Industrien gibt. Als nächste Krisenherde identifiziert Rogoff Länder mit hohen Immobilienpreisen und massiven Staatsschulden. All dies führt Rogoff zu der Feststellung, dass er sagt, die Zeit der Dominanz des US-Dollars läuft aus. Aber es wird nicht eine einzelne Währung sein, wie der Renminbi, der den US-Dollar ablöst. Er geht davon aus, dass wir es in Zukunft mit einer tripolaren Welt zu tun haben. Einer Welt, in der US-Dollar, Euro und Renminbi einen geteilten Einfluss haben. Und dieser geteilte Einfluss quasi dazu führt, dass diese drei Währungen miteinander konkurrieren, sich ein bisschen disziplinieren, aber eben widerspiegeln, dass wir uns nicht mehr in einer unipolaren, sondern in einer multipolaren Welt bewegen. Ich persönlich fand es so spannend, sehe persönlich die Rolle des Euros deutlich skeptischer und vermisse auch in dieser tripolaren Welt den Faktor Gold. All dies war für mich Anlass, Professor Rogoff zu kontaktieren und ihn um ein Gespräch zu bitten.
Unsere Welt ist ein Universum aus Impressionen, Wissen und Informationen. Allein auf deinen digitalen Devices, in deinen Cloud-Accounts und auf deinen Sticks und Drives liegt mehr Content, als du im Alltag verwerten kannst. Jetzt stell dir vor, dieses Wissen wäre jederzeit intuitiv und smart für dich nutzbar. Dann mach es einfach mit Acrobat. Adobe Acrobat Studio schreibt die Regeln neu. Mit PDF Spaces verwandelst du deine Sammlungen aus Dateien und Websites in gemeinsam nutzbare Wissenszentren. KI-Assistenten helfen dir dabei. Als Analysten, Assistenten oder Entertainer liefern sie dir präzise Themeninsights, neue Dokumente in deinem Stil und kreativen Input für deine Präsentationen. Mit Adobe Express gehst du den nächsten Schritt. Hier erstellst du schnell, effizient und intuitiv herausragende neue Inhalte, Infografiken, Präsentationen, Flyer und Social Media Posts. Die beeindruckenden Visuals dazu liefert dir Adobe Firefly mit generativer KI per Text-to-Video und Text-to-Image. Selbst das klassische PDF-Management bekommt mit Acrobat Studio ein Upgrade. Nie war es so einfach, Dokumente zu bearbeiten, Dateien zu kombinieren, Verträge elektronisch zu unterzeichnen, PDFs zu redigieren, zu vergleichen und zu schützen. Wissen, Produktivität, Kreativität, alles in einer Suite. Mach es einfach mit Acrobat von Adobe. Mehr Informationen in den Shownotes oder unter adobe.com.
Bevor wir zu meinem Gespräch mit Professor Rogoff kommen, noch kurz ein Hinweis für Hörerinnen und Hörer, die zu den Themen Wirtschaft, Politik und Finanzen rund um die Uhr auf dem Laufenden sein möchten. Unter dem Link handelsblatt.com/mehrperspektiven können Sie das Handelsblatt für 4 Wochen lang für nur 1 Euro abonnieren. Den Link zum Angebot finden Sie natürlich wie immer auch in Shownotes zu dieser Ausgabe. Doch nun zu meinem Gespräch mit Professor Kenneth Rogoff.
Kenneth Rogoff ist ein amerikanischer Wirtschaftswissenschaftler und Schachgroßmeister. Zu Beginn seiner Karriere war Rogoff als Ökonom beim Internationalen Währungsfonds und im Direktorium des Federal Reserve Systems tätig. Derzeit ist er Inhaber des Moritz-Boas-Lehrstuhls für internationale Wirtschaftswissenschaften in Harvard. Sein Buch This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly ist im Oktober 2009 erschienen. In seinem aktuellen Buch Our Dollar, Your Problem untersucht er den globalen Aufstieg des US-Dollars und zeigt, warum dessen zukünftige Stabilität keineswegs gesichert ist.
Wie immer bei englischsprachigen Gästen hören Sie nun die zentralen Aussagen im Original mit anschließender deutscher Übersetzung. Das vollständige Gespräch finden Sie am Ende dieses Podcasts. Zu Beginn des Gesprächs stellt Professor Rogoff klar, was seine Forschung über die Beziehung von hoher Staatsverschuldung und Wirtschaftswachstum wirklich besagt. Ich hatte ihn angesprochen auf seinem Bestseller This Time is Different. Er betont, es gehe eben nicht um eine magische Schwelle, konkret um die Hürde von 90% Staatsverschuldung relativ zum Bruttoinlandsprodukt, sondern um einen statistischen Zusammenhang. Hohe Schulden des Staates gehen im Schnitt mit geringeren Wachstumsraten der Realwirtschaft einher.
No, absolutely. One of the simple things we observed is that if you look at very long periods over a lot of countries, all the advanced countries and
eines der einfachen Ergebnisse unserer Forschung ist, betrachtet man lange Zeiträume und viele Länder, zeigt sich, dass hohe Schulden im Durchschnitt mit schwächerem Wachstum einhergehen als niedrigere Schulden. Erstaunlicherweise ist das kontrovers diskutiert worden, obwohl es eigentlich dem gesunden Menschenverstand entspricht. Wer Finanzkrisen, Kriege oder Pandemien bekämpfen will, steht mit geringerer Verschuldung besser da. Die Öffentlichkeit und zum Beispiel auch Paul Krugman verwechseln oft Defizit und Schuldenstand. Es ist großartig, sich Geld leihen zu können, aber dauerhaft hohe Schulden zu haben, ist nicht so großartig.
Angesichts von Populismus, alternden Gesellschaften und steigenden Militärausgaben sieht Rogoff ein klares Risiko, dass die Inflation wieder zu dem Mittel der Wahl wird, um die Schuldenlast zu bewältigen. Eine Einschätzung, der ich mich ausdrücklich nur anschließen kann.
If you look at the populism, you mentioned, Daniel, the aging societies.
Angesichts von Populismus, alternden Gesellschaften, steigenden Militärausgaben und hohen Schulden besteht eindeutig das Risiko, dass Inflation erneut als Mittel zur Entschuldung eingesetzt wird. Es gibt aber auch andere Wege. Die Trump-Regierung hat offen über einen teilweisen Zahlungsausfall gesprochen. Und das sollte man nicht auf die leichte Schulter nehmen. Eine weitere Möglichkeit ist die sogenannte finanzielle Repression. Japan etwa zwingt Versicherungen, Pensionsfonds und Finanzinstitute, Staatsanleihen zu halten, um die Schulden im System zu binden.
Die Feststellung für Rogoff ist klar, die Dominanz des US-Dollars als Weltreservewährung bröckelt. Ein Grund dafür ist, wenig überraschend, auch die Handelspolitik. Die hohen Zölle untergraben nicht nur den Warenhandel, sondern führen auch zu einer Veränderung von Finanzströmen und ändern damit die Attraktivität der Währung.
Tariffs, if you put up high enough tariffs, it blocks your financial transactions too. At the end of the day, you need to be able to get your money in and out.
Hohe Zölle blockieren nicht nur den Warenhandel, sondern auch den Kapitalverkehr. Am Ende muss Geld frei fließen können, hinein wie hinaus. Hohe Zölle zerstören diesen Mechanismus.
And it turns out that that basic logic, 100% tariffs kills
100% Zölle legen den Finanzhandel komplett lahm, 17% schaden ihm bereits deutlich. Wenn die US-Zölle im Durchschnitt 26% erreichen, wäre der Euro als Reservewährung attraktiver als der Dollar. Die Rolle der Zölle darf man daher nicht unterschätzen.
Wenn die US-Tariffs 26% on average, the Euro will be a preferable reserve currency to the dollar. You can't ignore the tariff role.
Wir wissen, dass Donald Trump oftmals sagt, der starke Dollar schade der US-Industrie. Kenneth Rogoff hält das für Blödsinn. Der wahre Preis für die Dollardominanz ist ein anderer.
I think the big cost of being the reserve currency, and I argue this in my book, is having to maintain a strong military. That's a very important part of being a reserve currency, both in the obvious ways your money is safer if you're the reserve currency, but also in more subtle ways it gives you.
Die eigentlichen Kosten einer Reservewährung liegen, das schreibe ich ja auch in meinem Buch, in der Pflicht, ein starkes Militär zu haben. Das ist ein zentraler Bestandteil einer Währungsdominanz. Zum einen sorgt militärische Stärke für Sicherheit, zum anderen verschafft sie politische Verhandlungsmacht bei der Gestaltung des globalen Finanzsystems.
The euro will become a bigger reserve currency. Of course it will. Well, the Trump administration's forcing you to do that, and I think a consequence is the euro will become more important. I know you think it can't. It has all these challenges.
Und weil die Trump-Regierung Europa in diese Richtung drängt, dürfte der Euro künftig an Bedeutung gewinnen.
And I'm not saying it's going to defeat the dollar, but it could get a much bigger market share.
Und wie ist nun der Rückgang des Einflusses der USA zu bewerten? Rogoff sieht Nachteile für sein Land, aber aus einer globalen Perspektive auch Vorteile in einem ausgewogeneren System.
We lose influence and power and there, first of all, our interest bill will go up.
Die USA verlieren an Einfluss und an Macht. Unsere Zinslast wird steigen und wir verlieren die Möglichkeit, Sanktionen durchzusetzen oder den globalen Zahlungsverkehr zu überwachen. Aus amerikanischer Sicht ist das ein Nachteil.
We lose our ability to spy on everyone. Again, I'm speaking as an American. We use this, believe me. And I assure you, if you talk to German intelligence, they well know this. So think if you could only pay with American Express sees everything you do. But if you have a choice and you can pay with Visa, MasterCard or whatever you want, you can circumvent American Express. And everybody is looking to do that. So from the point of view of the United States, it's worse. I will say I have always thought it was dangerous to put
Es ist gefährlich, viel Macht in einem einzigen Land zu konzentrieren, vor allem wenn das politische System instabil ist. Ein stärkeres Gegengewicht durch Europa würde das internationale Gleichgewicht verbessern. Eine ausgewogenere Weltordnung wäre langfristig von Vorteil, nicht nur wirtschaftlich, sondern auch geopolitisch.
I actually think a world, and I'm looking geopolitically, not just economically, with more balance would be a good thing.
Die Einschätzungen von Rogoff zu China sind besonders interessant. Er unterscheidet sich durchaus zu meinen persönlichen Beobachtungen, über die ich in den vergangenen Wochen an dieser Stelle mehrfach berichtet habe. Rogoff bezweifelt die Kompetenz der chinesischen Führung, weil er sagt, unter Präsident Xi habe sich der Fokus von Leistung auf Loyalität verschoben.
I think the competency has fallen dramatically. President Xi puts a
Diese Kompetenz ist in China heute weitgehend verschwunden. Das Niveau der Führung hat stark nachgelassen, weil Präsident Xi Loyalität über Fachwissen stellt, ähnlich wie Trump es in den USA tut. Das eigentliche Risiko liegt im Verlust an Kompetenz. Was passiert, wenn eine Krise ausbricht und statt der besten Köpfe nur das B- oder das C-Team die Geschicke des Landes lenkt?
And you have the B-Team or the C-Team running China. I think that's where we are today.
Kenneth Rogoff stimmt der Einschätzung zu, dass Europa ähnliche Probleme wie die USA hat. Zunehmender Populismus, hohe Schulden, ungedeckte Verbindlichkeiten. Er verweist auch auf die extremen Eingriffe beispielsweise in Frankreich, wo bereits finanzielle Repression als Maßnahme umgesetzt wird. Gleichzeitig betont er aber, dass wir angesichts der externen Bedrohungen unter Umständen Inflation als das kleinere Übel hinnehmen sollten.
You know, in Europe has used financial repression a lot already to deal with the debt crisis. It can use it more.
Europa hat ebenfalls stark auf finanzielle Repression gesetzt, um seine Schuldenprobleme zu bewältigen, besonders Frankreich. Dort müssen Versicherungen teils 90-95% ihres Vermögens in Staatsanleihen halten, was de facto einer Zwangsfinanzierung gleichkommt. Dennoch ist das Risiko nicht mit Russland zu vergleichen. Wenn die Wahl zwischen 10% Inflation und dem Erlernen von Russisch bestünde, wäre die Entscheidung wohl klar.
If you had to choose between having 10% inflation and having to learn Russian, I think you want the 10% inflation. But yeah, no, you're
Erstaunlicherweise kommt Rogoff zur Feststellung, dass eine Welt mit mehreren Leitwährungen kein historischer Ausnahmefall sei. Rogoff erklärt, dass solche multipolaren Systeme in der Vergangenheit oft existierten und der Aufstieg und Fall von Währungen ein langsamer Prozess ist.
Radical transfer is where you go suddenly from A to B.
Ein radikaler Wechsel von einer Leitwährung zur nächsten ist die absolute Ausnahme. In der Geschichte gab es oft Phasen, in denen mehrere Währungen nebeneinander eine wichtige Rolle gespielt haben. Der spanische Peso dominierte im 16. Jahrhundert, blieb aber noch lange nach dem Niedergang der Armada bedeutend. Auch der niederländische Gulden war noch über Jahrzehnte prägend. Ein weiteres Beispiel ist die Übergangszeit zwischen dem britischen Pfund und dem US-Dollar in der Zwischenkriegszeit.
Actually remained important for some time. So we often have a multipolar system. The most recent clear case was between the United States and the United Kingdom between the wars.
Eine neue Weltordnung mit mehreren Währungsblöcken muss nicht zwangsläufig instabiler sein. Rogoff argumentiert, dass der Wettbewerb zwischen den Blöcken langfristig sogar Stabilität fördern kann, weil er die Macht einzelner Akteure begrenzt.
If everybody used the dollar, that would be very, very efficient. If the dollar, it were just sort of agreed, the dollar would be at the center of the system. But do you trust us? I mean, should you trust us?
Es wäre effizient, wenn alle den Dollar nutzten, aber sollte man uns wirklich so sehr vertrauen? Wenn eine einzige Währung dominiert und Donald Trump über alles entscheidet, wäre das kein wünschenswertes Szenario. Kurzfristig mag ein multipolares System instabiler wirken, doch langfristig fördert der Wettbewerb zwischen verschiedenen Währungsblöcken Stabilität, weil er Macht begrenzt.
You can't trust governments that far. You need a safety valve. But if you had the one currency and Donald Trump is deciding everything, do you really want that? I think obviously not. And so that's why, yeah, day to day, it might be more unstable to have three blocks. But over time, the competition between the blocks helps promote stability.
Wünschst du dir auch manchmal jemanden an deiner Seite, der dich vorbehaltlos unterstützt, dir den Rücken frei hält und im richtigen Moment einfach perfekt ist? Keine Sorge, wir reden hier nicht über Online-Dating, sondern über Online-Business. Und dafür ist Shopify die perfekte Lösung. Schon zehntausende deutsche Unternehmen vertrauen Shopify. Egal ob innovatives Startup oder traditionsreicher Familienbetrieb. Fritz Kohler zum Beispiel oder Reisintel, Otto Mohl, Sternglass, Y-Food und viele mehr. Shopify revolutioniert als Commerce-Plattform das Online-Geschäft von Millionen Unternehmen weltweit. Mit Shopify kannst du deine Produkte auf beliebigen Vertriebskanälen verkaufen, egal ob persönlicher POS auf Social-Media-Marktplätzen wie Facebook, Instagram oder eBay bis zur umfassenden E-Commerce-Plattform. Du kannst mit Shopify dein Geschäft verwalten und ausbauen, unkompliziert und rechtskonform zugleich. Du hast Zugang zu einer stetig wachsenden Auswahl der innovativsten Funktionen und zu einem zuverlässigen Kundenservice rund um die Uhr. Produkte präsentieren, Inventar verwalten, Bestellungen und Zahlungen reibungslos abwickeln. Shopify bietet dir alle Tools, die du brauchst, um dein Business zu managen und das an einem einzigen, vertrauten Ort. So kannst du dich auf das Wichtigste konzentrieren, dein Business. Teste Shopify kostenlos und bring dein Geschäft auf das nächste Level auf shopify.de. Made for Germany, powered by Shopify.
Ich habe damit Professor Rogoff auch über die Stablecoins gesprochen. Wir wissen, Stablecoins sind Instrumente, die im Prinzip nichts anderes sind als ein digitaler Geldmarktfonds. Man kauft quasi für Dollar diese Stablecoins, also digitales Geld, und dieses digitale Geld wird dann gedeckt durch kurzfristige US-Staatsanleihen. Damit, mit den Zinsen, verdienen die Anbieter ihr Geld, während die Investoren oder die Stablecoin-Halter letztlich auf Zinserträge verzichten. Das Ganze dient natürlich dazu, die Finanzierung des US-Staates zu erleichtern und vor allem auch Ausländer dazu zu motivieren, US-Staatsanleihen indirekt zu kaufen, indem sie Stablecoins kaufen. Doch Rogoff hält das, wie viele andere auch, für durchaus gefährlich. Er glaubt, es könnte am Ende zu einem massiven Schaden auch für die USA führen.
Around the world for tax evasion above all, illegal activity, crime. That's already the case today. And the what the US seems to fail to realize is it's going to cost the US Treasury far more money in lost taxes, far more money in enforcing drug laws.
Die Nutzung von Stablecoins wird weltweit zunehmen, vor allem zur Steuerhinterziehung, für illegale Geschäfte und für Kriminalität. Was die USA übersehen, das wird sie am Ende teurer zu stehen kommen, durch entgangene Steuereinnahmen und höhere Kosten bei der Bekämpfung von Drogenhandel und Menschenhandel, als sie durch den Verkauf von Staatsanleihen gewinnen. Das hat schon Connolly gesagt. Unser Dollar, euer Problem. Heute könnte man hinzufügen, unser Donald, euer Problem. Diese Politik wird wie ein Bumerang auf die USA zurückfallen und sie merken es nicht einmal.
Might I say, the stablecoins are our Donald, your problem, and we're just going to do to you whatever we want. It's going to have a boomerang effect on the United States.
Es ist kurzsichtig und töricht, so weiterzumachen.
I think it's absolutely penny wise and pound foolish to do what they're doing.
Rogoff sieht keine Zukunft für einen Goldstandard. Aber eine wachsende Bedeutung von Gold als Reserveasset für Zentralbanken, die nach Alternativen zum politisch unsicheren Dollar suchen.
Gold in reserves, gold is an asset, gold is an investment. I think it has a very strong future.
Gold wird als Reserve und Anlageform weiter an Bedeutung gewinnen. Zentralbanken kaufen zunehmend Gold, weil sie dem Dollar nicht mehr vertrauen. Trump und seine Berater haben sogar offen darüber gesprochen, Zahlungsverpflichtungen gegenüber Investoren oder Regierungen nicht zu erfüllen. Die Nachfrage nach Gold dürfte daher weiter steigen. Es bleibt ein monetärer Vermögenswert. Eine goldgedeckte Währung wird es allerdings nicht geben, vielleicht in kleineren Staaten, aber nicht in den großen Volkswirtschaften.
We're not going to see a gold-backed currency, maybe in El Salvador or something, but not in the major countries. It's a terrible idea, even though you can find certain, you know, fanatics who still believe it could come back.
Besonders für die USA prognostiziert Rogoff eine wachsende Gefahr. Der politische Unwille, die Defizite zu kontrollieren, macht das Land extrem anfällig für den nächsten unvorhergesehenen Schock, der dann eine Inflationswelle auslösen könnte.
We have debt that's out of control. Neither political party has any incentive to bring it in. The US is running a 4% primary deficit right now, on top of the 3% that's interest. And oh, maybe it'll turn out to only be 3 with growth or tariffs. So it's very big. There's no incentive to rein it in.
Die US-Schulden sind außer Kontrolle. Keine der beiden Parteien hat irgendeinen Anreiz, dagegen zu steuern. Das Haushaltsdefizit liegt bei rund 4%. Hinzu kommen 3% Zinslast. Solche Ungleichgewichte verschwinden nicht von selbst. Wahrscheinlicher ist, dass die langfristigen Zinsen allmählich steigen, bis ein externer Schock kommt. Ein Konflikt mit China, eine neue Pandemie oder eine Klimakatastrophe. Dann wird der politische Druck wachsen, die Unabhängigkeit der Notenbank aufzuweichen und Inflation zuzulassen.
Something, a climate catastrophe, something I can't even imagine, that requires a massive increase in spending and puts a lot of pressure on the government budget. They're going to get some cold water. I think there will be pushback. I don't think the appetite is infinite. And that's when there'll be a lot of pressure to undermine Federal Reserve independence and have inflation.
Welche Schlussfolgerung ergibt sich daraus für Deutschland, habe ich Professor Rogoff gefragt. Wie sollten wir uns in diesen unsicheren Zeiten positionieren? Rogoff plädiert für eine Rückbesinnung auf alte Stärken und eine Neukalibrierung der hiesigen Politik.
It seems to me like Germany's lost some of its mojo, so to speak, by becoming more and more leftist.
Deutschland hat etwas von seinem früheren Schwung verloren. Die Wirtschaft ist weniger produktiv geworden, die Politik stärker nach links gerückt.
And Germany probably needs to find ways back to its strengths of efficiency, competitiveness.
Deutschland müsste zu seinen alten Stärken zurückfinden, zu Effizienz und zu Wettbewerbsfähigkeit.
And so I would favor, you know, in general an economic policy.
Im globalen Vergleich jedenfalls verliert Deutschland an Boden gegen die USA, gegen China, gegen die Welt. Und jetzt gilt es, sich neu auszurichten und an die Zeiten anzuknüpfen, in denen Deutschland wirtschaftlich geführt hat.
You're losing against the US, you're losing against China, you're losing against the world, and you need to recalibrate. You were winning not very long ago. And thinking about why you were winning and how to go back to those strengths, I think is very important.
Soweit die Auszüge aus meinem Gespräch mit Professor Rogoff. Wie gesagt, das ganze Gespräch im Original gleich am Ende dieses Podcasts. Was Kenneth Rogoff meines Erachtens unterschätzen könnte, ist die Rolle von Gold als vierter Säule dieses neuen Währungssystems. Wir haben gesehen, dass der Renminbi zurzeit nur etwas mehr als 2% der globalen Währungsreserven ausmacht. Gleichzeitig steigt der Anteil Golds rasant. Und Gold hat den Vorteil, dass man damit im Prinzip Handelsungleichgewichte ausgleichen kann. Man kann Gold bezahlen und man kann Währungsreserven in Gold zwischenparken und es damit inflationssicher anlegen. Die Tatsache, dass China selbst große Goldreserven aufgebaut hat und mit der Shanghai Gold Exchange die größte Börse zum Handel von physischem Gold besitzt, könnte als Indikator dafür gesehen werden, dass China in der Kombination mit Gold die Chance sieht, den Renminbi trotz der weiter bestehenden Kapitalverkehrskontrollen als ernsthafte Alternative zum US-Dollar zu etablieren. Gold selbst ist keine Währung im klassischen Sinne. Aber es ist das ultimative monetäre Fundament in einem System, in dem das Vertrauen in Fiat-Währungen, also das Geld, was wir verwenden, Dollar, Euro, Renminbi, schwindet. Das ist natürlich keine Frage der Zeit, sollte es wirklich zu wieder höheren Inflationsraten kommen. Europa steht vor dem Problem. Der Euro, gestartet als Konkurrenz zum Dollar, hat natürlich diese Rolle nie einnehmen können. Wie dargelegt, müssen wir weltweit überwiegend in US-Dollar bezahlen, wenn wir Rohstoffe einkaufen. Die Amerikaner haben sicherlich auch nichts getan, um uns dabei zu helfen, den Euro als Konkurrenz zum US-Dollar zu etablieren. Der Euro ist schwächer, als er sein müsste, einfach deshalb, weil Europa nicht liefert. Zum einen ist die Währungsunion nicht vollendet, zum anderen haben wir erhebliche wirtschaftliche Probleme. Stammhörer wissen, dass Europa relativ zu den USA und vor allem China immer drastischer zurückfällt. Beim Wachstum, beim Bruttoinlandsprodukt pro Kopf und vor allem bei der Innovationsfähigkeit. Wir sind das Museum der Welt und das ist nicht die Position, aus der heraus man eine Weltwährung etablieren kann. Kommt es Inflation im Dollarraum, so kann man davon ausgehen, dass Europa davon sicherlich nicht verschont bleiben wird. Denn auch hierzulande ist natürlich die Versuchung groß, das Problem der zu hohen Schulden mittels Inflation zu bereinigen. Der Dollar ist, das hat der William White auch in der letzten Woche gesagt, letztlich immer noch das weniger dreckige Hemd verglichen zum Euro. Natürlich könnten wir uns eine stärkere Rolle des Euros im globalen Währungssystem wünschen. Nur wünschen alleine genügt nicht. Wollen wir diese wirklich erreichen, müssen wir an unserer eigenen wirtschaftlichen, militärischen und politischen Stärke arbeiten. Und zwar in genau dieser Reihenfolge. Leider sind diese Erkenntnisse weder in Berlin noch in Brüssel breit verankert. Bleibt mir, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, Ihnen erneut sehr herzlich fürs Zuhören zu danken. Ich freue mich auf Fragen, Feedback und Kritik und natürlich auf ein Wiederhören am kommenden Mittwoch, wo wir im B2O Refresh nochmal zurückblicken auf ein Gespräch, wo es um das Thema Gold ging. Ich muss gestehen, wer zum damaligen Zeitpunkt Gold gekauft hätte, hätte kein schlechtes Investment gemacht. Bis zum Wiederhören wünsche ich Ihnen alles Gute, Ihr Daniel Stelter.
BTO Beyond the Obvious, featured bei Handelsblatt.
Dear Professor Rogoff, it's a true pleasure and honor welcoming you into my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Rogoff, I remember vividly during the financial crisis, you were very successful in coming out with a book called This Time is Different. It was spot on. And I think the basic premise was to say once government debt exceeds a certain level, the famous 90% threshold, this has a negative impact on economic growth, obviously amplifying then the problems of dealing with government debt.
As we currently speak, the US is far above 100%, France is far above 100%, Germany is working hard in order to pick up and to also grow its government debt. So are we now facing a situation where the Western world, due to its high debt levels, faces a problem of not being able to generate enough growth, and therefore we will see more government debt problems in the coming years?
So, Daniel, thank you. Actually, my 2009 book with Carmen Reinhardt did not have anything about debt and growth. That came later. We did develop a novel data set on debt, which no one had before then. And we wrote a very short 2010 note, but actually it was supplanted by a 2012 paper, which I think no one has had any criticisms of, which separates countries into buckets above certain levels, below certain levels. There's not a threshold any more than, you know, if you're driving in a place where the speed limit's 70 kilometers per hour and you go 69 kilometers or 71 kilometers, there's no real difference in your risk. If my cholesterol level is 199 or 201, there's no real difference. But no, absolutely, one of the simple things we observed is that if you look at very long periods over a lot of countries, all the advanced countries, and we included not so advanced countries like Greece, then having high debt on average is associated with lower growth than if you have low debt. And amazingly, this became very controversial because, you know, it's very common sense. If you want to fight financial crises, if you want to fight wars, if you want to fight pandemics, it's always better to have less debt. And the public, and I would say the polemicists like Paul Krugman, who talked about this, worked on the fact that most people don't understand, and I really mean this, the difference between a deficit, which is how much you're adding to your debt and your level of debt. It's always great to be able to borrow. It's not great to owe a lot. And of course, the United States is different because it's the reserve currency and the U.S.'s borrowing capacity is more. But, you know, maybe foreigners hold a 30% of U.S. debt, so it gives the U.S. more borrowing capacity. But I think what was sort of crazy is the idea it's just free, there's no cost, you just borrow as much as you want, which is amazingly prevalent, not only in the policy among left-leaning policymakers, and among many academics bought into that view until recently. And I think what changed and woke them up, I use the word woke, maybe with a double entendre, is that real interest rates went up. They thought interest rates would be low forever, which was ridiculous. There was all this discussion of secular stagnation. We'd never grow again. And now interest rates have risen and it's more painful. Conversely, Germany had a fairly low debt level by international standards and was in a great position to be able to react when it needed to, given the Russian military threat. You don't want to be borrowing money, but if you have a choice between having drones flying over Berlin and spending money, you spend money. It's good to be able to borrow when you need to. Germany's been in a much better position than France, which borrows money often when it doesn't need to, and now it's running into problems.
I'm with you here, but on the other hand, you know, if you look at how the new debt in Germany is spent, okay, it goes into defense, yes, but also it goes into closing some holes. And we always speak about the official debt. We don't speak about the hidden liabilities where governments have promises for an aging society. And so I'm always thinking about, okay, you know, we have the problem that, you know, the Western world is seeing more and more, at least, you know, issues in government finances, which even holds true for the U.S., because my understanding is, and please correct me here, that in the U.S. interest rates go up, long-term interest rates go up, and there are some people at least saying, well, this has to do with the fact that the markets start to think that probably down the road the U.S. will have to incur higher rates of inflation in order to cope with its debt.
Well, I mean, it's also simply that they're being asked to hold more debt. So I think U.S. really does get a privileged interest rate, even compared to Germany, given how much it's borrowing. If we were borrowing at the much lower levels that Germany still is, I think our interest rates would be a little bit lower. I mean, I think actually the markets don't have much expected inflation built in. I do think the risks of inflation are higher than the markets think. But surprisingly, even after the pandemic, where there was a big burst of inflation, the central banks have not been punished much for that. But if you look at the populism, you mentioned, Daniel, the aging societies, if you look at military needs, if you look at the high levels of debt, it's absolutely a risk that one of the ways of dealing with this will be another burst of inflation. There are other ways of dealing with it. The Trump administration has talked about partial default, and I wouldn't ignore that when they say it. There's what we call financial repression, which Japan has dealt with its debt by forcing insurance companies, pension funds, financial firms to hold debt. So has Europe to some extent, but Japan really to a great extent. Hasn't been great for growth. That's another way to deal with debt, but if you do it by eviscerating your financial sector and reducing your financial dynamism, that doesn't work either. Japan used to be the richest country besides the United States just 30 years ago, certainly 35 years ago. And now it looks like Italy in terms of its per capita income. There are many factors, but this high debt and financial repression has absolutely been a piece of it.
So in your new book, basically you say our dollar, your problem, which of course references to John Connolly's quote from 1971. So my question would be, well, you know, Japan, high debt levels, old society, Europe, not one unified continent, huge issues, demographics is very poor. And then you can look at the US and could still say, okay, Mr. Trump is currently president, but you know, he will be president forever. The US still enjoys higher growth rates. Yes, has higher debt, but still has the US dollar. And in spite of all what we have been saying, the role of the euro has not gone up in the past 20 years. So the euro did not gain share. And you also point out in your book that China is also not in a position to challenge the dollar. So you could say, okay, the world is a difficult place, but the US still might be the cleanest of all dirty shirts.
Yeah. Well, sort of there are two points here. One is simply that even to the extent the U.S. maintains its share, because it's not looking as safe as it was, I think there'll be diversification away from quote-unquote safe assets. We see this, of course, many central banks taking gold now, potentially other kinds of risky assets, but wanting to diversify away from the dollar. But also, the U.S. share has been falling the past decade. If you look at the dollar block, half of it is Asia. Remember, and you mentioned John Connolly, our dollar, your problem. He was Treasury Secretary under Richard Nixon and made this very arrogant remark, which my book title refers to. Europe's not in the dollar block anymore. And to think that China will be, and China's a very, very important part of the dollar block in 20 years. No, it won't. I mean, there's so many reasons having to do with sanctions, information sharing, the high probability of some kind of conflagration, cyber or otherwise. They're moving to develop their own back office, their own ways of doing transactions. And you said Europe's share is not doing well. Well, actually, Europe's share peaked just before the European debt crisis. If you look at different measures, but a simple one is reserve holdings. It was 25, 26% of global reserves. It fell to 18 or 19%. A lot of that had to do with the European debt crisis. That'll come back, and maybe it will do better with the European digital currency. I don't see the dollar being replaced necessarily. It's more that market share, which has been falling for a decade, is going to continue falling and maybe faster given Trump's war on the world. And if I can just say one other thing about that, tariffs, if you put up high enough tariffs, it blocks your financial transactions too. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you need to be able to get your money in and out. It's obvious we have 100% tariffs everywhere. Well, you wouldn't want to hold assets in the United States. It'd just be very hard to get your money out as a country if you wanted to. And it turns out that that basic logic, 100% tariffs, kills financial trade. 17% tariffs hurts financial trade. And actually, I have a student who just recently produced a paper. It's a little bit provocative, but carries this logic. He's very, very good. I was given at the Brookings Institution that if U.S. tariffs reach 26% on average, the euro will be a preferable reserve currency to the dollar. You can't ignore the tariff role. So there are a lot of things going on. Maybe we can talk about the independence of the Federal Reserve, which you're relying on if you hold dollars. And believe me, if you're sitting there in China with your, I estimate, $2 trillion in reserves, and you're not worrying about the Trump administration defaulting on you, you're not worrying about the independence of the Federal Reserve, you're probably going to lose your head, you know, a few years down the road.
You refer to the old quote of saying, our dollar, your problem. The Trump administration, they always seem to say the dollar is a problem for the U.S., because they always say, well, everyone takes advantage of the U.S. And I think you correctly make the point that, you know, the U.S. was benefiting a lot from this special position.
I think what the Trump administration's arguing here is essentially nonsense. It's a little piece. Their argument, just to state it for your listeners, is that because the dollar's the preferred reserve currency, the euro is second, but because the dollar's the preferred reserve currency, it bids up the price of the dollar, and that's hollowed out our manufacturing. Okay, point A is our manufacturing, which has actually increased the size of our manufacturing in recent years, but the employment has gone down because of automation. That's what's going on. Farming, people used to complain about we're losing farming back in the 70s. Well, the U.S. is an agricultural superpower, but there are no farming jobs anymore. And the same thing will happen in manufacturing. Okay, the high dollar hurts a little bit because of the reserve currency, but it also, we're good in tech, we're good in biotech, we're good in services, we're good in innovation. All of these things bid up the price of the dollar and are contributing factors. I think the big cost of being the reserve currency, and I argue this in my book, is having to maintain a strong military. That's a very important part of being a reserve currency, both in the obvious ways, your money is safer if you're the reserve currency, but also in more subtle ways, it gives you bargaining power in deciding how to arrange the global financial system, structure the International Monetary Fund. Trump is very crude about this. He may say to you, you know, someday I won't do anything. If you use the new Chinese clearinghouse system to do your trade, I will not defend you. You know, he'll say things like that. But of course, U.S. presidents did that before. Nixon, Reagan, Lyndon Johnson, they were threatening all the time. Military is a very big cost compared to the slightly higher dollar you might get from being a reserve currency. And ironically, I finished the book before I knew that Trump would be elected. I had a chance to write a sentence or two after the day after the election. That's it. I emphasize that if Europe ever builds up its military and becomes more of a geopolitical power, the euro will gain. The euro will become a bigger reserve currency. Of course it will. And it's not a simple linear calculation. It gives you more heft in every international negotiation. Well, the Trump administration's forcing you to do that. And I think a consequence is the euro will become more important. I know you think it can't. It has all these challenges. But it also has a lot of strengths compared to the United States. And I'm not saying it's going to defeat the dollar, but it could get a much bigger market share.
Are you unhappy or happy about the change of the role of the dollar? Or do you just say it doesn't matter. You know, but from an American point of view, would you have preferred that the dollar continues its role for the next 100 years? Or you say, no, it's better also for the U.S. economy. So what's your view about this?
Well, mostly, I think it's better for the United States to have the dollar. It gives us an enormous amount of power.
Basically, you're saying now with the lower importance or the relevance of the dollar, also the American government, the state, loses influence and power.
We lose influence and power, and there, first of all, our interest bill will go up. Maybe not a lot. Our interest rate is probably about 0.5% lower. I'm sorry, a percent lower than it would be if, say, the euro had the role of the United States. If we flipped, European interest rates would go down, U.S. interest rates would go up. We're not completely flipping. I think we're just losing market share, but you can think of our interest rates as going up 0.5%. But given how fragile our budget situation, that's real money. Even more urgently, we lose our ability to impose sanctions, which we've overused, but has kept us out of some wars. We lose our ability to spy on everyone. Again, I'm speaking as an American. We use this, believe me, and I assure you, if you talk to German intelligence, they well know this. So think if you could only pay with American Express. American Express sees everything you do. But if you have a choice and you can pay with Visa, MasterCard, or whatever you want, you can circumvent American Express. And everybody is looking to do that. So from the point of view of the United States, it's worse. I will say I have always thought it was dangerous to put so much power in one country precisely because our political system's unstable. Today, we have Donald Trump. Tomorrow, we could have, you know, Zohan Mamdani. You know, he's extreme in a completely different direction. And I think having Europe counterbalance this, not that Europe can't go crazy too, but it provides a little more balance. So I actually think a world, and I'm looking geopolitically, not just economically, with more balance would be a good thing. I can't see a world into the foreseeable future where Europe and the United States don't have very, very strong common interests, or I wouldn't be saying that. But yeah, I think it's terrible. On the other hand, if it's Europe that's gaining strength, I think it's good. If it's China gaining all the strength, given that China still has a very illiberal political system, it's very disconcerting.
Coming to China, because you make the point saying, well, China is not going to replace as US dollar. You have more of kind of a multipolar world with several currencies. On the other hand, you also describe the Chinese leaders to be highly competent. This is my understanding.
They used to be. What I say is, historically, the Chinese leadership was very competent. They had a remarkable system for choosing who would be the mayor, who would be the governor. They effectively were having growth tournaments, proof that you can do well in a smaller city or in a city and then go to a state, and that's how you got promoted. But today in China, that's gone. I think the competency has fallen dramatically. President Xi puts a total premium on loyalty. It's very ironic to be saying that given what's going on in the United States, where Trump puts loyalty above competence. He has some good people, but the average quality is pretty distressing. And in China, I think it's the same. And what concerns me about the loss in competency is not simply that they won't gain the same growth, that they won't, you know, be developed as quickly. What if there's a crisis and you have the B team or the C team running China? I think that's where we are today. And so I am concerned. So historically, I met a lot of the Chinese leadership and at all levels, and they were so impressive. I've met a great many American leaders and senators and European ones. And I mean, it's a mix, but on average, the Chinese were impressive, but I think less so today.
So what you're saying is the strong positions they have gained in certain value chains, like batteries, like raw materials, rare earth, EVs, meanwhile, and so on. You say basically it's look into the rear mirror because it shows us what they, how good the policies were in the past, but they're not an indication for the future.
Well, they have an incredibly dynamic private sector when they allow them to do things. And China, of course, it's the second most important economy, and it's a tremendous threat economically, politically, and in every other way. But the Chinese growth model is very, very dependent on building infrastructure, housing, basic things. These other things you point to, like green energy, electric vehicles, these are tiny compared to infrastructure, housing. They're going to get bigger, but they're not a replacement. Housing and infrastructure combined, looking at the direct and indirect inputs, accounted for a third of the Chinese economy until recently. It's gradually shrinking. You're not replacing that with solar panels and electric vehicles. The Chinese are incredibly creative people. They're doing things well, but I would say on the whole, they're not going to grow at anything like the rates that we've seen. Of course, for Germany, it's very inconvenient that where they are growing are things like electric vehicles, and Germany is so towering in producing automotive vehicles, and this is an incredible existential challenge to Germany.
It clearly is, and this also undermines, of course, the stability of the euro, given the fact that Germany is basically backstop of the euro.
Yeah, although I think some of it's going to require some soul-searching and rethinking of your policies over electricity, your policies over the environment. I've sometimes joked that Europe looks like California without tech or Hollywood. And California is our Europe. They aspire to be Denmark. And it's, the worst run state in a lot of ways, despite having all its advantages. And, Europe, there are a lot of good ideas. I'm very sympathetic to a lot of things. But there are really so many things where the Europeans have tried to behave well, and the United States has perhaps behaved badly. But, we live in a real competitive world, and China does the same as the United States, and Europe gets left in the dust. That shouldn't be acceptable for Europe. I mean, starting with electric power generation, if you don't figure that out, you're not competing at anything. AI requires a lot of electric power. AI is the key to building up your military. So something has to give. Maybe it'll be nuclear power. Maybe there'll be solutions. But I'm sure your paper writes about the regulatory state all the time. Like I said, if you go to California, it would look very familiar. But if you went to many other states, Tennessee, Nashville, you'd feel like you were in a very foreign country.
You have some history examples, from the Dutch guilder to the pound, and, from the pound to the dollar. Well, my recollection is that all these changes have been with a conflict. Okay, now the UK didn't fight the US, but there was a conflict then between Germany and the US and the UK. So this transfer of a monetary system, of an anchor currency, isn't this always associated with geopolitical conflicts?
Radical transfer is, where you go suddenly from A to B. But actually, typically in the evolution of currency, there's often a multipolar system. The Spanish peseta ruled the world in the 1500s. But even after the invincible Spanish Armada sunk, and after, Spain went bankrupt a number of times, the Spanish pieces of eight remained very important in the monetary system for another couple hundred years. The Dutch guilder actually remained important for some time. We often have a multipolar system. The most recent clear case was between the United States and the United Kingdom between the wars. However, after World War II, the dollar was at the center, but it was really just Europe and Japan. I mean, the Soviet Union wasn't using the dollar, the Soviet bloc, China wasn't using the dollar, India wasn't using the dollar. We had a multipolar system then, and there's some benefits to the system we have now, but it's not strange to have a multipolar system. But sure, for the dollar just to suddenly get wiped out, I have to say there's a movie last year called, I think, Civil War, which imagines some dystopian future. And one of the scenes, it's in the United States, everybody's fighting a revolution. And in one of the scenes, the protagonists need to get gasoline and they go to a gas station and they say, "Do you have cash?" "Yeah, we have cash." "Wait, we don't want US dollars. Do you have Canadian dollars?" So, I mean, you know, it can happen. But again, if we lose market share, it raises our interest rate, and it's a very big deal on weaponizing the dollar, on using the dollar for spying. If you ask European financial leaders and central bankers what they hate most about the dollar, it's not the slightly lower interest rate. It's all these other things, that the U.S. is back office to the world. We control everything. And I think there's modern technology with digital currencies. Blockchain provides an easy path for Europe and China to build their own back office, to weaken the U.S. grip. And I think that's going to happen faster than you can blink.
You worked for the IMF a long time, I'm understanding, and therefore you met with the most interesting people, as we already have alluded to. Can you imagine kind of a new Bretton Woods 2.0 where the countries come together and say, let's think about the future of the monetary system, given the fact that we get digital currencies and all this kind of stuff going on? Or do you say, well, this would require such a level of competence which is not available? But don't get me wrong, you know, I don't doubt your competence, but I mean, politicians normally, I doubt, will understand all the stuff in such a detail.
Well, certainly the change and the introduction of digital currencies just is going to call for more coordination. I don't know if it'll happen. But no, I think it's very difficult to do. The United States seems to have no interest in it. And even if Trump disappears, and even if you get somebody on the other side replacing him, the United States is just not going to be very cooperative. Europe's always cooperative, but you have to have a partner to cooperate with. China is not going to be cooperative. It would really take some kind of spark to have that happen. I think we'll have a multipolar system. There are many areas we're not going to cooperate, and that's just how it is. My late colleague, Richard Cooper, wrote, you know, very seminal work on international policy cooperation. And he said, basically, it almost never happens. You find cases like health, where there really has been, over long histories, countries cooperating on dealing with pandemics. But when it comes to currency, to macroeconomic policy, it's very, very difficult. Sure, we had a Bretton Woods, but the United States was the only game in town. We were 40% of global GDP. It was really a question of, you know, how the United States would run the system. The United States today, which has done better than anyone would have imagined, still's maybe a quarter of global GDP. China's rising. I actually, dare I say, predict that Europe will do some catch up over the next decade. So I think it's going to be very hard to have a new Bretton Woods system. Who knows? You know, maybe Donald Trump will take over the world and impose a new Bretton Woods system, but I don't see it right now.
Yeah, but I was asking because I can imagine your world, this multi-currency world, this multipolar world, but I would fear that this leads also to, well, not necessarily war, but conflict between the blocs. So if you now, if you just think about the China, Russia, Iran, India, at least if this is kind of a block, okay, India might be obviously a bit more flexible. Then you got Europe, which actually should belong to be close to the US, but currently not. So this could lead to conflict, to more trade barriers, to all this kind of stuff. And this would be harmful for growth. And this would, of course, be not good for the debt problems you're already having.
So there's certainly reasons to think that this period where I call it the PAX, Pax dollar era, was good. The U.S. Federal Reserve had very stable policy, made some mistakes, but it was sort of stable. Growth was good. And when we go to this new era, which won't last forever, but call it 20 or 30 years, 40 years of a multipolar system, will be more unstable. But on the other hand, there are advantages. Europe's feeling it right now. You know, when the United States controls all the power, they can do things you really don't like. That's the reason that we're going to have a multipolar system. It's efficient. If everybody used the dollar, that would be very, very efficient. If the dollar, it were just sort of agreed, the dollar would be at the center of the system. But do you trust us? I mean, should you trust us? Just look at it from the point of view of business. You'd like to have some choices. You'd like to be able to diversify. So it's an interesting debate. I wrote a paper about this, 25 years ago, where I argued that an ideal world would not have just one currency. It's really not what you want because you can't trust governments that far. You need a safety valve. Not everybody accepts that. My thesis advisor was Rudy Dornbusch. His thesis advisor was Bob Mundell, so I regard him as my intellectual grandfather. He didn't like that paper. He said the optimal number of currencies is one. We should just have one currency. You're way off base. But I ask you, if you had the one currency, I'm not trying to sound anti-Trump, but if you had the one currency and Donald Trump is deciding everything, do you really want that? I think obviously not. And so that's why, yeah, day to day, it might be more unstable to have three blocks. But over time, the competition between the blocks helps promote stability.
Would you also go a step further like Hayek and say you need private currencies to have much more competition? Also, not only between the blocks, but also within the regions that you've got other private alternatives?
Well, I mean, Hayek's just wrong about that. I think long history has proven that. And unfortunately, we're about to find that out again with the proliferation of stablecoins and the legitimization of cryptocurrencies. I don't think this is going to end well. I favor central bank digital currencies. I think stablecoins are a brilliant invention, but they need to have a lot more shackles on them before it's something we really should unleash on the world. I think we're going to see many bankruptcies with stablecoins, just as we did in the 1900s for a very long time. I don't think the world of private money is fantasy. The governments also have a lot of power. Governments never let the private currencies win. They have the power to, what do you pay your taxes in? How does the government pay people? What's the unit of account in your trading books? Many, many levers the government has. The governments are not always the creators of new ideas. There almost never are. But eventually, they make the rules of the game, and they keep changing them until they win. So we're never going to have a world of private currencies, though they have provided a lot of innovation, and we've seen that recently.
It's funny because, you know, when we look at stablecoins, U.S. stablecoins, you have the discussion going on in Europe saying, well, it's very smart by the Americans because they create something which goes global and is basically backed by short-term U.S. government debt. So it's a way of securing future funding in order to grow the stablecoin market. So every German can, with one click, move his money into U.S. dollar-backed stablecoins or U.S. treasury-backed stablecoins. And this time seems to be already one piece of the future, of the competition between the currency blocks.
Okay, so there are two levels of this. One is it actually backed by treasury bills? And a lot of it's going to end up being banked by bank accounts that aren't insured. There's a lot of debate over what actually has to back them and how do they make a profit. But I think a larger question, which no one seems to be talking about, is the stable coins, they're very difficult to audit. They're being treated like cash. But in the sense that the issuer of the stablecoin needs to know who they issued the stablecoin to. After it leaves, just like the way it when cash leaves the bank, they don't need to know anything. So we're going to see a rise in the use of these stablecoins around the world for tax evasion, above all, illegal activity, crime. That's already the case today. What the U.S. seems to fail to realize is it's going to cost the U.S. Treasury far more money in lost taxes, far more money in enforcing drug laws, human trafficking, et cetera, than they're going to gain by placing treasury bills. And lastly, a lot of the demand for stablecoins is going to come from bank accounts, from money market funds, from people who are already holding treasury bills. So I think there's a very clever idea there with stablecoins. I think there's a future, but the U.S. has basically unleashed a problem on the whole world, thinking it's bad for everyone else, but it's good for the United States. And it brings me back to the title of my book. John R. Connolly said, "Our dollar, your problem," when the U.S. went off the gold standard and the European leaders were upset. Part of what appeals to me about the whole thing is that it's ironic. It was our problem when we went off the gold standard. It was as bad for the United States as anybody. We had this terrible inflation. We had very slow growth. And right now, might I say, the stablecoins are our Donald, your problem. And we're just going to do to you whatever we want. It's going to have a boomerang effect on the United States. People don't seem to realize that. And I think it's absolutely penny wise and pound foolish to do what they're doing.
Do you see any future role of gold in the system? Because, you know, you mentioned we spoke about the central banks buying gold now and diversifying out of the dollar. On the other hand, we all know gold-backed currency is just a stupid idea because you are hindering growth. Do you see any kind of role gold can play in the future?
So my book actually is constructive about gold. I'm not anti-gold. I don't think we should go to a gold standard where it's backed by gold. One idiotic review of my book, most of the reviews were very generous, and this one was nice too, but it was still idiotic, had the point that why is anyone talking about the dollar? We should just be on a gold standard. Why are we even talking about this? Everyone knows we should be on a gold standard. No, it would fall apart quickly. It's just a stupid idea. But gold in reserves, gold as an asset, gold as an investment, I think it has a very strong future. Central banks are going to be collecting gold for as far as the eye can see. They don't trust the dollar. I mean, Donald Trump, his people have openly talked about defaulting on our debt to institutional investors, to governments. I think this demand for gold is going to continue to rise, and it is a monetary asset, but it's not going, we're not going to see a gold backed currency, maybe in El Salvador or something, but not in the major countries. It's a terrible idea, even though you can find certain, you know, fanatics who still believe it could come back.
Okay, gold is a good, we take this as a point. We already touched it a little bit. We spoke about inflation, and my understanding is you are basically predicting that we will experience another significant inflation shock within the next decade. Why so? Because we need inflation to get rid of debt, or do you see other structural reasons for inflation to be an issue again?
I say it's more likely than not, just to be clear. I'm an
academic.
Okay,
sorry, folks.
It's fine. I'm particularly talking about the United States, where central bank independence is not in the Constitution. It's actually much weaker constitutionally than it is in Europe. If the president and Congress together want to absorb the Federal Reserve back into the Treasury, they can do it in a week. This does not take a ruling from the Supreme Court. It doesn't take anything. Our Federal Reserve was created by Congress. Congress can uncreate it anytime it wants. And we have debt that's out of control. Neither political party has any incentive to bring it in. And we have this needs to spend on military, which we're not doing yet, but which we will. We have an aging population. We have tremendous populism in both parties, in the left and the right. Neither party wants to run a primary surplus. They're running large primary deficits. And just to be clear for your readers, the primary deficit is the deficit above and beyond just not borrowing to pay interest. If you're only borrowing to pay interest and you're not borrowing otherwise, you're in balance in primary. The U.S. is running a 4% primary deficit right now on top of the 3% that's interest. And oh, maybe it'll turn out to only be 3% with growth or tariffs. So it's very big. There's no incentive to rein it in. this doesn't come to a sudden end. I think what I predict will happen is more likely than not, long-term interest rates will creep up. And I particularly mean on the very long end. I don't know what will happen around Federal Reserve dynamics. They will creep up, and someday it will happen. A shock hits. I don't know what it'll be, a conflagration with China, cyber, real, otherwise, another pandemic, something, a climate catastrophe, something I can't even imagine, that requires a massive increase in spending and puts a lot of pressure on the government budget in a more measured way. That's what's happened to Germany. It'll happen to the United States. And every time it happens, we think, oh, the world loves us. Our debt was 30% of GDP. That was fine. Then it was 60%. That was fine. Then it was 90. Now it's 120. It'll go to 200. No one will care. They're going to get some cold water. I think there will be pushback. I don't think the appetite is infinite. And that's when there'll be a lot of pressure to undermine Federal Reserve independence and have inflation. So I don't think that's the end of the story. We may also have partial default. I think we'll have financial repression. Maybe we'll raise taxes and cut spending a little bit, but it's very hard to navigate. I think all of those things may happen, but the most likely is inflation. But maybe another shock won't happen for 15 years. Who knows? It's, you know, hard to know. I feel like we live in a pretty volatile world, geopolitically, economically. I'm thinking 4 to 5 years, but again, I can't even tell you what the shock will be for sure. But my gut instinct is we're very vulnerable right now to something happening.
Well, I follow you, and there's just one exception. You of course, you point out that formally the ECB is more independent than the Fed. On the other hand, all the other issues, populism, high debt levels, unfunded liabilities, it's all the same. And so, and the ECB, well, not officially, but they have now all the tools. They got all the tools now after the European financial crisis to support governments. And if you look into French politics, the discussion is relatively simple. They say either the Germans pay or the ECB is paying. So obviously, I would say, well, you know, what you said for the US is also going to be necessary in Europe.
For sure. I mean, I researched it less. I think we're looking at the United Kingdom. We're looking at many places where the problem is acute. You know, and Europe has used financial repression a lot already to deal with the debt crisis. It can use it more, although I don't know where you're going to put all the debt because you've already put it in insurance companies, pension funds. I'm stunned by the restrictions on insurance companies, in particular in France, where they have to hold something like 90 or 95% of their assets. I may have this wrong, but that's what a major insurance company told me recently. And you know, that's a crazy way to hold your portfolio all in bonds. And, you know, that's what they have to do. But yeah, no, it's certainly a risk. That said, coming back to an earlier part of our conversation, it's not as big a risk as Russia. I mean, that's like, you know, if you had to choose between having 10% inflation and having to learn Russian, I think you want the 10% inflation. But yeah, no, you're at risk, and the French situation's pretty distressing. And you're right. That's the, you know, every time Germany's bailed France out, and of course they expect that.
Yeah, but on the other hand, also Germany is running out of, sometimes we also run out of ammunition, and it is also not going to work with populist parties. I recently had a discussion about the Chicago plan. You know, Irving Fisher, 1930s Chicago plan, going for sovereign money. Even Martin Wolf from the FT wrote, I think in 2012, an article saying he likes the idea. And there was this paper it was published by the IMF, but it was not officially an IMF paper, by two economists basically saying, well, they did the calculation with today's tools and they said it would work. And this would basically lead to a different monetary system. At the same time, it would help the government get rid of its debt. Do you think it's an interesting idea? And secondly, given your experience with politicians, do you think it would be possible to implement such a plan?
Yeah. First, I write a lot about this in my 2016 book about cash. And I write about it a little bit in the current book. The Chicago plan is basically to get rid of banking crises by forcing banks to hold government debt. So there's just no concern with backing them. Well, we're moving full speed towards the Chicago plan with stablecoins in the United States. They're supposed to be backed by treasuries. They're going to suck money out of the banks. There's no doubt about that. And we'll move to what we call narrow banks. That's the core of Irving Fisher's idea. The narrow banks don't do traditional lending. They just lend to the government and they're safe. The problem is, and the reason no one's want to rush into that is, well, how does everyone else borrow? What does the market buy? That a hardware store, that a auto manufacturer, the government's taking all the money. How does everyone else borrow? I think eventually we'll figure that out, but we're very, very far from that. And that's really the main objection to the Chicago plan, is that we need other ways of We need other people besides the government to be able to borrow money. How are we going to achieve that? It's doable. Theoretically, it's not really a problem. But practically speaking, it's hard to move overnight to a new system. But you're asking that as a very abstract question. I don't want to say exactly where, but in a high-level official meeting this morning, my time, exactly about stablecoins, how they're going to disintermediate the whole system. Central bank digital currencies are. What are we going to do about it? The Chicago plan has a modern guise, which is exactly digital currencies.
As my podcast is also heard by politicians in Germany, probably as to the end. And I know you have always contacts to governments and so on and so on. If you now, based on your view of the coming year, so we have structurally, we will have some kind of inflation coming back over time due to the pressures we discussed. We have the multipolar, multi-currency world with its pros and cons. We have the challenges we are facing given demographics, given defense needs, and so on, and the high debt levels. So if you now came to Germany and said, okay, I discussed with the government what to do, what would you recommend the Germans to do if they want to do the best for their people in order to navigate these difficult times?
I hesitate to try to give a comprehensive, here's everything you should do plan. I don't pretend to know, and I'd have to ask a lot of people. But, you know, it seems to me like Germany's lost some of its mojo, so to speak, by becoming more and more leftist, and the economy has become less productive. You see all the numbers about this. And Germany probably needs to find ways back to its strengths of efficiency, competitiveness, and trying to be like Denmark probably is not going to work for Germany. And so I would favor, you know, in general, in economic policy, some move back to the center. That's sad. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to so many of the social issues, the environmental issues, but you're losing. You're losing against the U.S., you're losing against China, you're losing against the world, and you need to recalibrate. You were winning not very long ago, and thinking about why you were winning and how to go back to those strengths, I think, is very important. Obviously, AI is a big thing. If you want to build up militarily, you can't let Germany be nothing in AI or totally beholden to a couple U.S. companies that dominate in AI. That's going to require building up in electricity, which we've discussed is very challenging. You know, I see with Chancellor Merz talking about some of these issues, rather frankly, more than we've heard in a long time. And that's good. I mean, that Germany is a very wealthy country. It's done very well, but it's not had as good a period recently. There's just no doubt about it. When that happened back in the early 2000s, you know, the German people and the German leadership got together and figured out what should we do and came up with some pretty good ideas. And I'm sure the same talent is there to think of them. But it is hard in today's world. It's so populist. It's very, very difficult to move what I would call more technocratic or centrist policies. And maybe it's just not possible. But surely the competition with the rest of the world, the realization that things aren't going as well as they were going, ought to be a bit of a slap in the face to try to recalibrate.
Professor Rogoff, one can hear that you have lots of experience of discussing with politicians because you crafted your words very clearly, but we understood it. I think the message was clear, but the wording was careful. So thank you very much for this. It was a very interesting conversation. I wish you all the best, and hopefully you can keep in touch. And when you get another book or another paper, I would be more than happy to have a discussion with you about it. It would be really great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I still have a lot of messages coming out of this one, so might be a while before another book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.